The Word of God is alive and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of the soul and the spirit, and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All Scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to 1 Timothy chapter 6 and in your notes to the doctrine of materialism. All right, God has provided a simple method of salvation for all mankind. That is simply faith in Messiah, the person and work of Jesus Christ, with respect to the matter of sins and all of that. And even so, he has established a phase two method for spiritual advance. We refer to it as the gap system, because God has provided through grace everything we need to continue to learn and to grow up in all respects into the head, even Jesus Christ. And so there is a system that we adhere to. This begins first fundamentally with the assembly and face-to-face teaching in the local church. This is the classroom of Christianity. This is also the only authorized disperser of the truth in terms of the organization that God has chosen. We have temporarily, Israel has been set aside, and the church, that nation comprised of people from many nations, is now the agent who is responsible to represent God's truth to the world. And through this system, we can assemble under the ministry of the pastor-teacher, under positive volition, intellectual honesty, being in fellowship. All these things are critical if one is going to master the realities of the Christian way of life and live in a way that is effective before God, that glorifies Him, and that produces the ability and the potential for great reward. And certainly, probably, there's no area in life we spend any more time with than that's in our marriages, in our home. And so, therefore, there is great potential for doing the right things or the wrong things in that environment. So we are here to learn the truth and to be reinforced in the things we've already heard. So it's time to make sure you are prepared if you have not dealt with your sin nature. 1 John 1:9 is the order of the day. And if you have, then anything else you need to do to put aside distractions and focus your attention on the teaching, now is the time to make those adjustments as well. Let us pray. Well, Heavenly Father, we thank you for the great grace that brings us together, recognizing that from eternity past, you knew all things. You knew we would be living in the most dangerous time in human history, second only to the time of the flood in terms of its sheer evil, and that we would find ourselves in a nation like Jeremiah that is destined for destruction, but that ultimately you continue to provide for your people for positive volition throughout history, as you always have, and the truth is still available. The very same truths that got Abraham through his life, David, Saul, all the rest of them, Paul, all of these people recognized the principles of your word and applied them to the experience of life. We thank you that we are in your great family and pray that we would continue to advance and demonstrate ourselves to be disciples indeed. We pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we're here dealing with a doctrine that is certainly all over the place in terms of what we see in the world today, particularly appropriate to life here in Babylon, political and economic Babylon, where all things have been turned on their ears, and the evil that is slowly taking over the whole world, of course, has done its share of damage in this country as well. And one of the key elements we continue to see in these prophecies is the wealth of Babylon, the luxury, the security they think they have. Because of this, many people believe that wealth makes them secure, but the fact is, wealth does not. Wealth can be lost very quickly. Solomon deals with this in the book of Ecclesiastes when he points out that through bad investments, things can go south, and you may plan ahead all you want, but ultimately, God has to be the one to take care of the positive believer. This requires that we walk by faith, that we prioritize, that we have our priorities in order, and that we execute those priorities on a systematic basis. It's not enough to be hit and miss in terms of the truth. You get out of this, as Jesus pointed out, only what you bring to the table are you going to get out of it. So if you're not giving your all, if you're half-assing it spiritually, well, then guess what? You're not going to be blessed very much. You're going to wonder why God isn't for you. Well, God reads everyone's tape, and he knows what makes people tick. And certainly, what makes a lot of people tick here in Babylon is money and the things it can get for them. It's not just money itself. It is the details, the vacations, the luxuries, the things that people can have. And again, many of these things are fine in their place. We're not here to denigrate all things good. We are here to say they're fine in their place as long as the believer keeps the proper mental attitude about them and remains oriented to the priorities of the Christian life. It's when these things get in the way of the Christian life that it becomes problematic. So we were into the introduction to this. Again, we pointed out there was this young man who turned away from following the Lord simply because his money was more important to him than anything else. And so he walks away from being a disciple. And because he was more concerned with material things than he was with spiritual things. And the challenge in the last days, where we live in a world that's largely cosmic and largely material oriented, that the believer loses focus and begins to become and live. And many believers, in fact, today live like functional unbelievers. They live just like their unbelieving counterparts. And that's not good. This is not what the Lord seeks. So, again, as we point out, people are shocked, again, about other sins, many sins, the shocking sins, adultery, murder, rape, criminal activity, all of this. People are shocked by this, but they're not shocked at drunkenness, all these kinds of things that you can see. But they're not shocked by materialism anymore. They don't find it to be problematic in many cases. And sadly, this goes to the top, and the pastors will not teach against this. Because they've fallen into this lust for material things and money and the details of life. And that is the death knell of a ministry right there. When you get into that mindset, the teaching will suffer. Eventually, it will go by the wayside, and the emphasis will be placed in the absence of sound exegesis, hermeneutical principles being adhered to rigidly, and all of that. You open the door to almost anything. And that's what we're seeing in the angelic conflict. Churches that at one time were sound, pastors that were, are going off the deep end in droves almost. And because they will not stick with what we are supposed to be doing. Because number one, it's not glorious. The work of the pastor is likened to that of an ox walking around in a circle, treading out grain over and over and over and over again. Never gets old though, does it? I can't stop my arm. That it's not glorious. And people get tired of it. And I get that. I tire of it sometimes. But you have to fight the fight. You have to pull up your bootstraps sometime. Put on your big pants and go out and play and get it done. And so, otherwise you're unprepared. And that's another whole thing that's verboten for a pastor to step in the pulpit and be unprepared. You are to be prepared in season and out. I don't care how difficult it gets, and that's easy to say in the nice light of classroom, but in the reality of the angelic conflict, you may be forced to live this out. And as I've told you from day one, for those of you who are here all this time, everybody's feet are going to be put to the fire in the angelic conflict. We're going to find out what everybody's made of, and nobody's going to escape it. The testing is going to come. Jesus informed us of that in the parable there about the two builders. One built on the foundation of sand. He went out and built a nice house on Siesta Key. Whoops. Then when the storms came, the other person, they went down to bedrock. They anchored their home on a firm foundation. And in both cases, the storms of life come. Whether you're prepared for them or whether you're not, they come. And of course, when the house falls on the unsound foundation of unsound doctrine, this fall is great. The destruction is magnificent, we might say. So again, we have the problems in here. The Bible, again, speaks as much to money and the details of life as any other issue, even as to salvation. And we left off here under point F as we were beginning this. His teachings are reinforced by the teachings of the other authors of the New Testament. All of these, the first four here, are from Paul. And then Luke in Hebrews 13:5, as you might expect, very much reflects Paul's mentality and his doctrine. And we left off with 1 Timothy 6:17. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited. Number one, you didn't get your wealth because of your great genius. You didn't get your wealth apart from God's grace. Whatever wealth or prosperity you have, and that varies from believer to believer. This is why we don't judge one another. I don't look at people and say, well, they don't have any money, God's not blessing them, therefore they must be out of fellowship or something, or negative. No. That's superficial and shallow, and we are not to judge external circumstances like that without some more information. That falls short. So, or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. People begin to trust in their money. They think money is going to make their future secure. And that's what they're gambling on. You're gambling that money is secure. And guess what? Money is not secure. In one place it says it makes itself wings and flies away. Now, I don't know what you conjure up when you see that, but I see your 50s and 100s just fluttering in the breeze. That's what I conjure up. Wealth is not designed to be permanent. And if it's not used properly, it's worse than worthless. It's deadly. It's dangerous. People have succumbed to this issue as much as anything. But of all the, when we saw in the doctrine, the parable there of the sower and the soils, one of the key elements that Jesus talked on in there that will trip people up is this money and the details of life. And it chokes out divine good production because you can't have time to do everything. And so priorities have to be determined, and how you spend your time tells me what your priorities are. That's just a reality. That's true whether you're a believer or an unbeliever. How you spend your time betrays your priorities and what's important to you. So there, don't fix your hope on the uncertainty, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works. This is what counts. How are you going to be evaluated at the Bema Seat? Your bank account? No, Jesus isn't going to say, show me your passbook and let's see how you did. No, you're going to be judged by your deeds. We're told this repeatedly. So better be rich in good deeds, in divine good production, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future. See, the good foundation isn't the money you have. The good foundation lies up in heaven. And that's where the treasure really matters. What treasure you accumulate here won't matter. You're losing it all anyway. I'm losing it all anyway. Nobody's getting out of here with a stitch of anything. So this ought to instruct believers the relative value of details and money and all of this. And what sacrifices am I willing to make to be in Bible class five times a week, even if it costs me some of these things? Will I take a lesser job? Will I step back? And some people say, no, I can't do that. I won't work for X amount of dollars. Okay, so that's the way it goes. But that's not the scriptural attitude that we're supposed to manifest, unfortunately. And then the last one, Hebrews 13:5, here. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money. Being content with what you have. Well, wait a minute. If I'm content with what I have, I don't need to go buy anything more. No, you really don't. I mean, if you need something, it's one thing if you need something. If something breaks and you have to replace it, everybody in their right mind knows that's a legitimate expense. It's when you have something for 2 or 3 years and they come out with the iPhone 10 and you've got to have it. No, you don't have to have it. I'm against Apple or any of these companies. I don't care whether it's a Samsung. It doesn't matter. People are just all too quick to spend money on things that they think they need. And now, I don't know how often you hear people use that. Well, I need this. Really, you need it. This maybe we ought to do a little short search in Webster's on what the word need means. Why do we do this? Because he has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you, so that we may confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I'm not worried about my bank account because I don't rely on that. I rely on God to take care of me. And obviously there's a balance in here that we have to maintain. And, you know, there's a premium in the Bible on diligent and hard work and all of that. That's all a part of good character. But the idea that I'm going to do it and God's not in this and I'm going to take care of it all myself, that idea is fallacious. Well, gee, the subjects of money and matters related to it are found over 100 times in the New Testament. And someone has calculated that the New Testament speaks more about material matters than it speaks about the issues of heaven and hell. And I got to believe those are pretty important. I got to believe your eternal destiny is fairly important. And there is a sense in which the matter of materialism should be considered as a part of basic doctrine, particularly here in Babylon. But it's rampant around the globe. If people have it, they tend to spend it. They tend to want it. So since it is so fundamental to the human condition. And NJ, as will be observed, the problems of wrong attitude about money and material things is simply the result of allowing the sin nature to dictate. Adhering to human viewpoint and or rejecting or failing to apply Bible doctrine. This gets, again, to the matter of priorities. If I know what my priority is, 5 Bible classes a week, then I have to arrange everything else under that. And everything else has to be subservient to that, if that's indeed my priority. And so, you might have to make hard decisions. People have had to relocate for doctrine. Some of you have relocated for doctrine. I've had to twice in my life. I hope to never have to do it again. I pretty much think this is my settled niche. And even though I didn't get the mountains, I won't cry much. It's not a bad place to live unless you hate red tide. The reality is here, people should recognize, hey, okay, God's got me where he wants me. I'm growing. I'm getting the teaching I need. It's available. Then I need to do everything I can to maximize. That's a part of the mentality, the all the more mentality, as you see the day approaching. All the more in terms of attendance, application, exhortation, encouragement, these kinds of things, and all of that. So as will be observed, point J, the problem of wrong attitude about money and material things is simply the result, again, of allowing the sin nature to dictate. K, one fundamental question before every believer is whether or not he or she is going to serve God or money. Since no one can serve two masters, not my words. For he will either hate the one and love the other, or he will hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. And for the Babylonian, that translates also into details, vacations, all the things that money can buy. All the things, you know, luxury resorts. And there's nothing wrong with going to a nice place. Nothing wrong with vacations, as long as they're kept within parameters that are reasonable. So point 2 here, vocabulary. A, the Hebrew vocabulary. While there is no specific vocabulary in the Hebrew Old Testament that deals specifically with the issue of monetary lust, there are general terms that are used to denote the concept of material greed. In that regard, words that are translated as greedy are often words that deal with the concept of wanting things, craving things, desiring or lusting after them. 3 here, the verb batsa, which literally means to cut off, is used in some contexts to denote greed or covetousness. It is similar in meaning to our phrase, rip-off. And we all know what a rip-off is, don't we? Anybody ever been exposed to one of those? I got this deal. I'm really looking into it because I think I'm going to be wealthy here. I got this deal from this Nigerian prince. For from the least of them, even to the greatest of them, everyone is greedy for gain. Jeremiah 6:13. And from the prophet, even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. You actually have a very strong construction in here. Everyone is greedy for gain. You got that term ripping off. They ripped off. They want their cut. They do this. They pursue this. It's a cal infinitive absolute there with a follow the cal perfect of the verb. Also Jeremiah 8:10. And of course, this is what happens when a society decays. You see it even in the religious realm, that those who are not consistent with sound doctrine are going to fall prey to this and very often end up promoting it. Therefore, I will give their wives to others, their fields to new owners. Because from the least even to the greatest, everyone is greedy for gain. From the prophet even to the priest, everyone practices deceit. And if you find out your pastor is a material reversionist, it would be time to get a new pastor. You say, well, he hasn't done anything overtly. He just likes money and details. What kind of message does this send to the flock? This sends the very wrong message. Now, I'm not against people being prospered. God prospers people. It just says there in Timothy, God gives us richly all things to enjoy. But again, waiting on these things, living by faith, and not pursuing them is the matter here. That's what the issue is. Materialism, lust, of course, it was prohibited in the Mosaic Law. Prevented, it wasn't prevented. But it was prohibited. Exodus 20:17, a part of our favorite, the Ten Commandments. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not covet his male servant or his female servant, or his ox or his donkey or his stereo or his TV or his car or anything else that belongs to your neighbor. Don't steal his lawnmower. What is wrong with people? Well, we know what's wrong with them. It's the old sin nature. And it's rampant out there. So there it's prohibited. Also, Deuteronomy 7:25. This is not new news, obviously, to us who've been around for a while. We know that God is not in favor of greed, covetousness, lust after these things that people think are going to make them happy. And again, the problem is it never makes them happy. If buying things made you happy, you'd only have to do it once. But it doesn't. It's a treadmill. It's a wheel you just keep running on. And of course, our whole culture is geared to this. That's why the advertising industry, that's why all this stuff of Google, every time you're online, they're not only tracking you, they're picking up on your preferences, targeting you with certain ads. They know how to get to you. This is big money. This is big business. And so when you wonder, well, why'd that pop up? Oh, yeah, I might be interested in that. Oh, well, it worked. It's called targeted advertising. So the graven images of their gods you are to burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or the gold that is on them, nor take it for yourselves. You will not be snared by it, for it is an abomination to the Lord your God. Well, 5, materialism, lust was obviously the source of Achan's sin. In Joshua, he brought discipline upon the entire group by his violation of this, and we've seen this word under the ban. We've seen this in Jeremiah, that things were devoted to the Lord. People were not to deal with them, to touch them, and certainly not to take any of them for themselves. But the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the ban. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the ban. Therefore the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. And this is called cursing by association. You think, well, I wouldn't go hang out with a known adulterer. But would you hang around somebody that pursues material things all the time? But that's considered normal. And so that's not considered abnormal in our society. But it's, in the Bible, they're in the very same category with rapists, murderers, and adulterers. Those who want to, the swindlers, those who are trying to make money in a dishonest way. And it is set forth as a characteristic of the wicked in Proverbs. Proverbs 12:12. And the wicked are the negative unbelievers out there. They live a particular lifestyle. Now, it varies from person to person. But they have a particular cosmic mindset. And they're a part of the cosmic system. The entire cosmos lies, reclines, lays back on the lap of the wicked one. So they're comfortable with all of this. That's another whole issue. That's 1 John 5. People are comfortable with the devil and his viewpoint. That's sad. Believers shouldn't be. They should recognize it. The wicked desires the booty of evil men. But the fruit of the righteous, the root of the righteous rather, yields fruit. The Greek vocabulary here, pleonekteo, the verb is used 5 times. It means to take advantage of someone, used of defrauding, exploiting, or cheating someone in order to obtain money or material possessions. 2 Corinthians 12. And this was very a regular feature, in fact, of these false teachers that had invaded Corinth and that were opposed to Paul. And it was their emphasis on money and the details and accumulating things. And Paul's emphasis was opposite that. It was not trying. Matter of fact, he never took money from the Corinthians at all. And it was to make a point to these people that these men you're listening to, this junk, is wrong. And I set an example that it's wrong because I don't cater to it. And I will not take money from y'all. And the Corinthians were a pretty wealthy congregation. They lived, Corinth was a materially wealthy place. And up there at a level in some places at a par almost with Athens. It was quite a cosmopolitan place. Here, 2 Corinthians 12, 17 and 18. Certainly I have not taken advantage of you through any of those whom I sent to you, have I? I urged Titus to go, and I sent the brother with him. Titus did not take advantage of you, did he? Did we not conduct ourselves in the same spirit and walk in the same steps? And all this time you've been thinking we're defending ourselves to you. We're not. We're here to, it is in the sight of God that we have been speaking in Christ and for your upbuilding, for your edification, beloved. And so that one there, taken advantage is the word that we're looking for there. That's the verb. Pleonektes, a noun 4 times, one who desires more than what is needed. A covetous or greedy person. Ephesians 5:5. For this you know with certainty. And if you don't know it, you might want to commit this one to memory. This is a good one to learn. That no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater. The worship of money and the details of life is idolatry, just as if you got yourself a little Buddha and bow down to it every time you walk by. This is another way of bowing down to an external god. That takes the place of the true God. And as you know, our God is a jealous God. He doesn't care for it. And he makes that plain. So know that they do not have an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. If you're living this type of lifestyle, it is going to materially affect your eternal rewards package, your SG3. You're not going to inherit like you should. And in fact, you may lose much of your inheritance if you live this kind of a lifestyle. The immoral person sins against their own body. The covetous person is an idolater. So, an idol worshiper. Pleonexia, a feminine noun here, 10 times, the state of desiring to have more than is due or necessary. Greed, avarice, insatiability. 2 Peter 2:3, and this might not be shocking to find out that false teachers promote this among people. This is popular. The prosperity gospel has been around for a long time. And there are certain people who still fall for it no matter what. They're not sound in the faith. 2 Peter 2:3. Talking about false teachers will come in among you who will secretly introduce destructive heresies in verse 1. Up to and even denying the master who bought them. Their theology will suffer and their Christology will begin to go take a hit as well. They will not teach who Jesus Christ actually is and what it is he actually wants. And they will bring swift destruction on themselves. Many will follow their sensuality. Well, sensuality has always served religion in terms of bringing more numbers in. The Vestal Virgins in the cults, well, they weren't virgins. And the temple prostitutes and all of that. And they had male and female temple prostitutes. That if you have a religion where let's get together and worship God and have sex, that's going to appeal to a certain segment of society. And they're going to love the immoral aspect of it. And all in the name, of course, of we're just demonstrating Christian love. No. That's not what Christian love is. Immorality is not Christian love. I'm sorry. It's immorality. And so this sells, as we know. And because of them, the way of truth will be maligned. And in their greed, they will exploit you with false words. They have to. Because they want money. Really, it's about the money. And I can safely say it never has been for me. And at this point, it still isn't. And I hope it never is. If it ever becomes about the money, I'm doomed. I'm not fit for the ministry if it becomes about the money. So you have to be willing to, if you have to take a step back, you have to take a step back. That's just the way life goes. And you have to be willing to do that. If you're going to maintain your integrity. Now, if you don't care about your integrity, you can do whatever you want then. But I want to maintain mine. Here at point two, phil arguria, a noun, literally that means to love silver. A fondness for silver, the love of money. It's also avarice or greed is another way of translating it here. 1 Timothy 6:10. And this is in the very famous verse that's almost always misquoted. Money is not the root of all evil. That's how most people say it. Money is the root of all evil. No, it's not. Satan is the root of all evil. Money is neutral. But the love of money, that's a different thing. I believe that's our noun there, phil arguria. The love of silver is a root of all sorts of evil. Why? Because people will violate all manner of things and commit all manner of immorality to get money. Some of them, prostitution is one aspect of this. The love of money may end up in sex crimes. The love of money may end up being, you may end up being a hitman. You murder for hire. Other people, their love of money will cause them to compromise and do other things. Some may be more gross and sinful than other aspects of it. Here's where stealing comes from. It's a love of money in the details. Taking what is not yours. And what's the motive for that? See, so the love of money, it's a root. And that means you don't see it. But you see the results of it. You see the results of the love of money. And they take various forms. It does not bear good fruit, though. No good fruit comes out of the love of money. Nothing good comes out of that root. So phil arguros, adjective, two times, one that has a greedy disposition. One that is prone or known for being fond of money. One who wants to be wealthy. Luke 16:14. And so as we consider these matters, and this is really a bad situation when your religious leaders are the worst offenders. God help us. What are sheep going to emulate if they've got pastors up here who are promoting this love of money and the details and not teaching against it, not standing against it? See, long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, there was Star Wars. And you know, when I first came onto doctrine, I was taught that you place Bible class first, and everything else has to fall into line. And I don't care what sacrifices you have to make. If you had to give up a good job to stay in class, if you had to relocate to get sound teaching, any and all sacrifices were a part of that as I understood it. And I still believe that's the way the Christian life is to be lived. Is with these orientation to, again, proper priorities. And money, the pursuit of money, gets in the way of that. Because, and then people begin to rationalize, well, I got to pay my bills. Sure you do. Nobody's saying you don't. But how much are people willing to sacrifice? That becomes the real issue. It's a matter of attitude, but it's also a matter of willingness. How much are you willing to give up? Nothing. Okay. God likes that attitude, he told me. He said, that's how I want my children to be. No, that's not at all. Now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, were listening to these things and scoffing at him. Oh, why would they scoff at him? Because he was talking about money, and if you don't learn how to use money in this world, why in the world would God entrust you with anything in the next? You couldn't even handle the basic principle of money. And so in the teaching here, he says, verse 10, he who is faithful in a very little thing will be also faithful in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? Nobody in their right mind. You know, God won't. That's the whole point of this. And if you have not been faithful in the use of what is another's, who will give to you that which is your own? No man can serve, no servant can serve two masters. He'll hate one and love the other. You can't serve God and wealth. Ha ha ha, listen to that. Ah, Jesus. Where does he come up with this? It's a show every day with him. You never know what he's going to say. 2 Timothy 3:2. That one we don't even have to look up. That's just one of those in that list of characteristics of the last days and why times are so difficult. Lovers of self, lovers of money. And those two probably go to some extent hand in hand. Not totally, but in some ways they probably do. And again, if you look at the description of times in the last days and you compare this to what we've seen of prophetic Babylon, how much of this fits? Oh, all of it? Lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant. Well, we've seen, how many times have we seen, oh, arrogant one, you're going to stumble and fall. Disobedient to parents, revilers. And it's intriguing here because children, you know, they don't necessarily tend to think, well, when I'm disobedient, it's not that big a deal. You know, I might get in a little trouble. I'm willing to risk it. That's the insanity of youth. Again, youth is wasted on the young, but what can we do? But that this in this list, this is just as apparent to Paul as a fundamental problem of society that, of course, that's why the Bible sanctions corporal punishment and not timeouts. That doesn't seem to fix it somehow. All right, definition and description. First, it must be stated that this doctrine is not dealing with the general philosophical doctrine of materialism, which means that the only reality, the only causes for what goes on in the world are physical things and forces that can be detected by the human senses of perception. A philosophical materialism is opposed to spirituality. It entails the rejection of God, spirituality, and even the idea of eternal moral truth. So, again, that's a whole philosophical system. We're not dealing with that per se, but this deal of materialism is certainly an outflow of that kind of thinking, that material things become the most important. And so hedonism becomes the name of the game because what should we be here for is to get what we can and make ourselves happy. And money does that, doesn't it? I guess. I don't know. It never has me. It's never really made me happy. So, see, this doctrine is designed to deal with a specific aspect of materialism, which is part of the lust grid of the sin nature, and which expresses itself in the preoccupation with money and the details of life. And Webster defines materialism, point D, as the tendency to give undue attention to material interests, devotion to satisfying the material nature and its desires. And biblically, it should be defined as the tendency to be more concerned with material issues, money and the details, than with spiritual values and priorities. And again, the nature of the cosmic system is one in which the believer, you're never going to win out there. Paul uses in Ephesians there, he uses an analogy about the cosmos, and he says the cosmos is like this big casino. And it's ruled over by a pit boss. If you've ever been to a casino, you know what the pit boss is. And the games are all rigged. It's all slanted in favor of the house. Now, you do know that. We don't have them as much down here. I think they got one, Hard Rock, maybe up in Tampa. But then you can go out to the dog track and play poker. But no Vegas-style casinos here that I know about. I mean, the Hard Rock probably is one. But I've never been up there. So I don't really care about it. But you have this system. The world is viewed as Satan is the pit boss, and all the games are rigged, and believers lead with their sin natures, and guess what? They lose. What a shock. And then there's that idiotic believer who, and you've seen this, and we translate this into the real world here, of, I'm going to win it all back. You're not going to beat the cosmic system. It's fixed. And if you think you're going to win it all back, you're delusional probably. And how many people, how many gamblers have gone out and said, well, I'm on a down street, but I'm going to get it back today. And then they end up hawking their car or their house or whatever else they've done. because they didn't get it all back. They didn't win. They were pursuing a fool's dream. And why are gambling places so... What is the lottery for? It appeals to the material. I don't care if you play the lottery, by the way. It doesn't matter to me. But why is it there? It's the get-rich-quick mentality. I'm going to buy this ticket. And I can win millions. And wreck your life in the meantime. Because if you go do any study on this, and it's easy to do, go research all the old lottery winners and see how their lives have gone. And it is a story of tragedy after tragedy after tragedy, and sometimes ending in death. One guy, this woman killed him to get his money because he won the lotto. And so, again, I love Stuart Wolf's take on it. What's the lottery for? It's a tax on people that can't do math. So we just tax the dumbest segment of society. Because the odds of you winning the lottery are less than you getting struck by lightning twice today. Let's go to the beach. Well, let's not. I don't think it's very nice out there right now. So, but again, if you want to play, I don't care. It's, you know, as long as it's harmless fun. When people begin to think they're going to win and they're going to get rich, and that mentality begins to take over, and they're buying scratchers when they can't afford bread. Well, I'll have plenty for bread if I just win. If you just win. 1 John 2:15-17, of course, this describes the entire cosmic system and the believer's attitude toward it, or what it's supposed to be. Do not love the cosmos or the things in the cosmos. If anyone loves the cosmos, the love of the Father, and that's to be taken here as an objective genity. You don't love God is what he's saying. That you can't love God and the cosmos. So in that regard, the teaching's very much parallel with you can't serve God and money. You can't love God and the cosmos both. For all that is in the cosmos, the lust of the flesh. This is lust which proceed from the flesh. Fleshly lust, you could even translate this. The lust of the eyes, the lust that the eyes incite. People see things shiny. I gotta have it. It's great. So many things come to people through the eye gate. This is how we perceive in many ways. And so, and this is why advertising is so successful. You need a luxury car. And I'm not against luxury cars. I've had luxury cars. Okay, fine. But it's just a car. It's going to die one day. I'm going to trade it in or get a new one, or it's going to rust. Something will happen. I pray that we don't get it into wrecks. I pray that all the time. God will protect all of us from the drivers. Other drivers. And even our own stupidity, because occasionally I've done some dumb stuff driving. I'm not proud of it, but you know, you didn't see somebody or something escaped your notice, or you were distracted for a second. So I pray constantly that God will protect us from all that. So the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride that comes from biological life. This is bios, as it were, not zoe. This is life that comes from the body. That people boast in their accomplishments. Look what I've done. Look how much I've made. Look at this great deal, this great company I built. All of these things that I'm so proud of. Well, pride in material possessions is misplaced. And so it is not from the Father. None of these things are from the Father. This all comes from the cosmos. And the cosmos is passing away. It is constantly, as it were, in a state of flux, constantly deteriorating. And this is all it does. And it never changes. It doesn't get better. It's only going to get worse. It's constantly passing away. And also, it's lust. But the one who does the will of God abides forever. And so, F here, the vocabulary terms deal first with the mental attitude sin that arises from the lust pattern of the sin nature, the love of money, which may or may not always express itself in some overt speech or act. You have to be careful because you have to listen to people and you have to pay attention to them. You can't see the love of money. It's a root. It's unseen. But it's there in some people. And so we have to be recognized as believers, this is part of the teaching. So we get on top of this. Because this area will destroy your life just as much as immorality, criminal activity, other things like that. This area is just as dangerous as any of those others. Well, gee, however, Paul makes it plain that the mental attitude sin of covetousness is the unseen root that sprouts into all forms of evil. We saw that in 1 Timothy 6:10. And hatred is one of the specific sins singled out as grounds for separation. 1 Corinthians 5:11. And again, many of these sins, people kind of nod and say, yeah, I expect that. Yes, I wouldn't hang around with that kind of person. Yeah, I can see that's wrong. I wrote to you because the Corinthians tended to, they were like sponges. They soaked it all up and got it all backwards. It was more or less what they did. And Paul would tell them, don't associate with believers that are engaging in flagrant sins. They took it to mean we can't associate with anybody that sins. Well, you can't go to the bank, you can't go to the store, you can't do anything. Unless you find some people that are sinless. And if you do, then don't let me know. Because I'll know you're a nut job. So I wrote to you not to... What I meant is what I'm trying to say to you people. Isn't a Corinthian, he's constantly doing this with them. What I actually meant was not to associate with any so-called brother. If he is an immoral person, covetous, an idolater, a reviler, or a drunkard, or a swindler. Not to even eat with such a one. You don't establish social life with no negative volition. That's the whole point. And even if there are believers, we are held to higher standards. And I'm not going to apologize for this. And we're not going to lower the standards. I know in America, that's what we always do. Now we've gotten the standards so low, everybody gets a trophy just for showing up. I don't think the Bema seat's going to work that way. I got to the Bema seat. Here's my trophy. No, I don't think so. I think you're going to be evaluated as I'm going to be evaluated. And the quality of our work is going to be tested. And that's why, again, I have always believed that you should make some time and get through the scriptures. You shouldn't take forever to get through stuff. Usually that's a sign of a pastor that didn't study it enough. But that's not always the case, but it certainly can be. But you have to make tracks. You can't just stop. And you know, I heard stories about this pastor who was like 12 years in a single book. I think it was the book of Hebrews. Now, Hebrews is 13 chapters. That's a chapter a year. That's too slow to my estimation. And what all is he teaching? I'll bet you money he was teaching a bunch of stuff that wasn't in there or wasn't germane to it. I don't think I could take a year to do a chapter. I think I'd go insane. So, as he says, you don't establish social life with these people. As believers, we have higher standards. And we're allowed to have. Now, this is not designed to promote self-righteousness. Oh, we're greater than all these people out there. We're not. We're sinners saved by grace, just like everybody is. Except for the grace of God, there goes I. You know, there I go. So there, the instruction to withdraw from the monetary reversionist would be pointless if it were not possible to know objectively when a person is consistently engaging in it. You don't have any trouble identifying the immoral person, do you? I mean, you know, if you had an associate or acquaintance here in class and you're around them frequently enough, you'd know if they were engaged probably in immorality. It'll slip. The people can't hide this stuff forever. Or if they worshipped idols. They got a little Buddha in their home and they bow down to it. You'd know that. You'd pick up on that. Reviler, that's obviously verbal sinning, slander, maligning, the Morton Downey kind of approach to life, the Jerry Springer. These are not Christians that are to be emulated. I don't even know if they're Christians or not. I doubt it. Or a drunkard. If you see somebody that's constantly drinking to excess, you know it. It becomes apparent. You can't hide these sins. Well, the reality is you can't hide covetousness either. It'll show up. And any discerning believer will see it. And you're supposed to be able to see it. This is a part of our royal imperatives. So too, while many believers have serious emotional and spiritual issues with those that commit immorality and other things in this list, and rightly so, how many instances can be cited of people separating from those who have made money and the details of life their first priority? I don't really remember anybody ever telling me I had to separate from them because they were constantly about the money. There may be one or two I've heard here and there, but it's very few and far between. And the reality is, of course, this is the priority of many people. Well, when it comes to the desire for money and material things, it appears to be difficult for most believers in the Laodicean era to see and admit that their own desires can and have become selfish and or excessive. And again, not because I'm perfect or anything. I mean, they got these little bracelets you can wear. Well, get your little WWRD bracelet on. And when you're thinking about this kind of stuff, ask yourself, what would Ron say, you think? And you'll have some clue, probably. Most of you know me, and you've been around, and you have some idea. Well, what does Ron think if I decide to do this? What will he say? Well, I know he won't like it, so therefore I'm going to hide it from him. That's what most believers do. And that's fine with me. It's just one less pressure on me. If you're going to hide stuff, that's fine. But unfortunately, God will bring it out at some point, probably. You probably won't be successful long term. God has ways of putting our feet to the fire. Well, Revelation 3 here. 3:17. Yeah, 3:17. Turn my page too quick. But here's the average Laodicean mentality. Because you say, I am rich. I got plenty of money in the bank. I'm fixed. If I didn't have to work now, for the rest of my life, I could live. And I have become wealthy, and I have need of nothing. But you do not know that you are wretched and pitiable and poor and blind and naked. Why? That's your spiritual condition. Physical condition, you may be doing well. You live out in Longboat Key in a gated community. You eat only at 5-star restaurants, etc., etc. You drink only the finest wine, smoke the finest cigars, live the life of Riley. And all of that, that's your average person in many ways out here. And particularly, we live in a county and a state where there's a lot of money. And I don't know if it's still true, but when I first moved down here in about 90, Sarasota was the richest county per capita in all of Florida. Now, I don't know if it still is, but you can just go down and drive along the bayfront and just look at the boats and see how much money's here. And because the mentality of the Laodicean church is that they're lukewarm. They don't keep their priorities straight. They're back and forth, and they're neither hot nor cold. They may be hot one day and cold the next, but they don't maintain it. And to be hot is to be diligent, to be on fire, as it were. Well, for clarifying the nature of the problem, A, it should be emphasized at the outset that there is no inherent virtue or spiritual value in being poor. We are not here to promote asceticism. Divest yourself of all your wealth, sell everything, and live like a hermit. And go find yourself a cave or something. It'd be hard to hear to find one, but... Go find yourself a cave to live in and divest yourself of everything. No, we've never advocated for that at all. There's a balance to be had in here. But unfortunately, I'm teaching in a time in history and at a time in the church age when the balance is way off here. And so to get it back to where we're supposed to be requires some real corrective, some harsh language of drawing people to these conclusions that they don't want to reach on their own. I don't want to think that I'm excessively consumed with myself, but some people are, and that's the reality. And this asks for their own spiritual good to be exposed, and this is a part of what we do. And it's not personal. I don't get up here and think I am against every idiot sitting here. I'm for every idiot sitting here. You're not idiots. I was kidding. I'm for people. I want them to make it. But the fact is, the reality is, the truth is much harder than people are willing to admit sometimes. And it costs more. There are sacrifices attached to it. So again, we're not telling you here to be poor, or that you're better off if you're poor, or that you're more godly if you're poor. None of that. That's not at all what we're getting at in any of this. Well, poor people may be very wicked. Or they may be very materialistic. Therefore, this should be recognized as an issue that comes from the old sin nature and not as an issue of income or money. There are rich, wicked people. There are wicked, poor people. Money doesn't change people internally. It doesn't make them good or bad. It can certainly influence them for the worst. We certainly know that. That's one of the dangers of money, is that people will begin to compromise to get it. And so, see, materialism is not a problem limited to the wealthy, any more than immorality is limited to the wealthy or any other segment of society. Again, poor people, rich people all commit the same sins in many cases. There are obviously certain differences because of niche. But The reality is, we're not here to tell you to be poor. But we're here to say, hey, maybe it's a little bit much in some cases. And I know people don't like hearing that. I get it. It's not popular doctrine. Especially in our day and age, it's not popular doctrine. And sadly, I'm one of the few voices out here on this. I know there's probably others, but I've watched pastors get into this materialism and to just do their ministry in. And that's a cautionary tale. It's, again, the jury's out on all of us. So in other words, the rich, the poor, and everyone in between may be equally materialistic. And F, while ascetic religions, those that renounce material comforts and promote a life of austerity, like the Gnostics tended to do, at least one branch of the Gnostics, which led off into the rise of the monastic orders in the 3rd and 4th centuries A.D., this idea was that you could cure sin by withdrawing from society and denying yourself bodily comforts. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great? I'll just go off and sit in a cave for 2 days and my sin nature will go away. And I just never be troubled with it again. No, it doesn't work that way quite. And if Paul talks about that, I believe, people that engage in strict regimens on the body but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. So you'll see this, and again, coming up in the holidays, you get the, especially around Easter, particularly in these Catholic environments, and Hispanic cultures are a lot of this. There'll be people who go literally, they'll whip themselves, beat themselves, literally let themselves be nailed to a cross. And you know what that's done for their sin nature? Not a thing. Hasn't addressed it at all. But if I'm me to the body, that'll prove how godly I am. No. You can be godly and rich. You can be godly and poor. We don't make those judgments because we don't know. So those that renounce comfort teach that participants are expected to pursue a life of poverty. It must be noted that Christianity is not an ascetic religion. Matthew, and I use the word religion even advisedly there, but hopefully in context you understand. It's not like these other religions of the world. Matthew 11:19. And here it deals with this in terms of the differences in the two ministries that these people observed. The ministry of John the Baptist and the ministry of Jesus. And we'll have to wait because Jesus said it's time for the break. So we'll have to go ahead and take our normal 20-minute break. We'll pick up here at 5 after.